Bringing your guests.
Okay, now we're live. Good evening, everybody. This is Teresa Dietze and David Franco with our 13th group session of Practical Work on Self. If this is your first time on the call and you'd like to speak, then you can mute and unmute yourself using star 6 on your telephone keypad. And other than that, here we're ready to rock and roll.
Last week, and last week we worked on the chapter. We finished up with a chapter on centrum of gravity question, and I think we got into that at a nice refresh and depth level. And it just occurred to me, I was wondering if anybody wanted to share anything more about the centrum of gravity questions. Did anything come up for you, or is that just something we're going to hold in our little tool bags for the next few weeks?
Mike Williamson, may I read your comment that you posted on the website?
Sure, but he asked about the question. I just wanted to say one thing about that. Last week, I got really it really helped me with a quote about love being the first cause and the last effect. And I was asking myself about, well, you know, what does that mean? You know, I mean, it means nothing to me really in a sense. And I just kept holding it, and I have been. And so it was our working with the question that really helped me with that. So I just wanted to say that.
That helped you with what?
But yeah. It helped me with probing this contemplation of love is the first cause and the last effect.
That's a wonderful contemplation.
You know, it's interesting because one thing I just noticed in you sharing that, Mike, is that for some reason it seems like you've taken that to a little bit of depth for yourself, that it has meaning for you. And as you share it like that, it had meaning for me, okay? And for me, right at this moment, that idea of love is the first cause and the last effect happens to be extremely timely. Literally, like in the last 24 hours, that's a missing link in something that I've been working on. So your efforts at mining it, and then just the fact that you shared it, not that you shared any like linear knowledge of it or anything. Just the fact that you did the work helped me see it in a fresh manner. Make sense?
Oh, yeah. That was something I was working on this week, too, saying we're all interconnected and love has no walls. Love motivated by breath has no walls. So you can see the connection there, I think.
Yes, thank you. Anyway, that's the reason why I thought that we should just touch base on the centrum of gravity question, which was the chapter 11 from a couple of weeks ago, but it was lingering in the air for me, so I wanted to touch base on it again. Thank you for that. And then last week, what we finished up with was the chapter on sensing, chapter 12. And now I got stuck on an area on chapter 12, and I was wondering if, is Silverdale there this evening?
Yes.
Okay. And on chapter 12, if we look at page 114, and we look at the paragraphs 2 through 5 there, there's a conversation of, in setting us up to help us understand what sensing is, EJ is talking about a couple of contact, the whole context of the octave. And for some reason, I thought maybe you could help us understand that just a little bit and how he's posing it in that particular area. We didn't really talk about it because I don't think any of us really, I didn't understand it. And I thought maybe you could help us over that little hurdle.
You know, 18 years later, I'm getting closer to fully appreciating what this is describing. But what I do know now, more or less with a great deal of certitude, that this probably is referring to, is that sensing has to do with the vibratory sensation of our essential self, that is the non-phenomenal life-animating force within our physical body. And over time, that vibratory sensation is perceived to have seven different tones. And those tones can be played like a melody on a piano. And so that's what these paragraphs are referring to. But before you can play a melody between these seven tones, which are individual vibratory sensations, of the octave of of the sensing of the non-phenomenal self. Listen, it's taken me a long time to understand, but that's more or less what this means. And I read the book as it was published in 1979, as I mentioned in my previous comment, and verified for myself that, yep, that's what Gurdjieff, I think Gurdjieff wrote the material originally, and that's what he was referring to.
Okay.
So. What about when he's talking about the using the rosary, and he's talking about 1 and 4, 2 and 4, 2 and 8, 8 and 5, 5 and 7, and back full circle, the tension of forces represented as 7 and 1.
T, are you familiar with the Enneagram at all?
Yes.
Okay. Then, as you know, there are we are, as human beings, we're supposed to be able to independently deflect two different laws, the law of three and the law of seven.
Yep.
Now, of course, that's just so much gobbledygook until you, you actually start doing it.
Well, we have a few people on the call who don't know what the Enneagram is, and I would love it if you could give us just a little more information so they would understand the answer to this question, too.
Okay. The, again, the best way to answer would be by an illustration. We are all comprised of three separate, independent, autonomous, diverse, co-equal, and diametrically opposite forces. That's what makes us like the absolute. Each one of these three forces is subject to the law of seven, which simply means that everything goes in a circle. Everything returns to face itself. Now, it's simple once you can do it, but it's complicated to grasp initially. So each of these three forces is subject to the law of seven, which is subject to very specific movements, one of which is the Enneagram.
And what is the law of seven?
The law of seven is everything in the universe is subject to points of deflection. resulting in everything going in a circle and returning to its origin.
What's being deflected from what? Are you talking about, for instance, would the fact that the protons, neutrons, and electrons don't bump into each other in the atom, is that an example of this? Do they deflect each other?
Boy, Teresa, I'd have to take a moment to formulate in my mind an answer to that. You know, it's like asking the question, you know, does light move in waves, or what is that? Does it move in waves, or is it subject to
particles,
or is it are they particles? Well, it's not. It's both and. You know, it's, and so this law of seven. You know, let me just try and again simplify this one more time.
I'm really sorry. I'm not trying to put you on the spot. I just don't know what's being deflected from what, and I'm certain there's other people who don't either.
Hey, you know. If we look at the human lifespan is a an illustration of what I mean by deflection. Something gets started at our moment of conception. It proceeds in a given direction for a definite period of time, at which point something changes. So, for example, the first 9 months, we might say, is the first period of time in the human life before it is deflected, that is, birth occurs. We might say that it then continues on a certain path until puberty, at which time it is deflected again and starts on a new path. It can't continue on the old path. It's because it's run out of out of energy and then kind of starts on a new path. So, and then we might say that at the age of 20, we come to the end of another stage, and it's deflected, and we are into a new stage of growth and development. Till we'll say the age, I'm just making these numbers up now.
Sure,
but,
yeah.
You know, until the age of 40, at which time we've kind of reached the midspan of our lives. We've run out of the original energy of our conception, and so the deterioration of energy begins, and that's another point of deflection. That is, we are entering into another path, so that, anyway, when we draw our last breath, we have completely run out of energy, we've been deflected again, and we've come back actually to the moment of our conception, you know, in a strange sort of way. And that's what this Law of Seven is. That's one illustration of the Law of Seven is, in fact, I'll tell you, hold on just a second. Well, this Law of Seven becomes very important because you have to understand it's how it works in order to be able to use it. That is, you can know that there are notes on a piano, but if you want to play a specific melody, you have to learn it, how to play each of these notes.
Okay, so this would probably come back again to the question about using the rosary, and you were going to link that into the Enneagram, but we need to know what the Enneagram is.
Okay, and by the way, if I could just read to you what Beelzebub says about the Law of Seven.
Oh, please, go ahead.
Since this is the most, it might not make any more sense to you, but it's a very good definition. Regarding the Law of Seven, cosmic objective science formulates it in the following words. The flow of forces follows a line that is constantly deflects at specific intervals and unites again at its end. According to this primordial sacred cosmic law, the line of the flow of forces has seven points of deflection, or as it is otherwise said, seven centers of gravity. And this distance between two consecutive points of deflection, or centers of gravity, is called a stop binder.
It's called a what?
So And the complete process of this sacred law acting through everything newly arising and existing is always made up of seven stopbinders.
Seven what?
This becomes the seven stopbinders, just seven gaps. Seven gaps.
Can you spell that, stopbinders?
Yep.
Is that right?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. It's a word. It's a word that Gurdjieff made up. You won't find it in any dictionary in any language in the world. But
okay.
It is. It is spelled S T O P I N D E R.
Okay.
So, in any event, this is important. This is important because once you understand this, you understand that what the Absolute did was he actually, in order to create the now existing creation, he modified the three of these stopbinders, three of these gaps. One he lengthened, one he shortened, and one was disharmonized as a result of what he'd done to the other two. And that's the fundamental problem that we're all dealing with as we seek personal evolutionary transformation to higher levels of being and reason. If you want to become like God, you've got to undo what the Absolute did and redo it for yourself. Within that context, the Enneagram becomes a very useful tool for understanding exactly how to do that.
And tell us what the Enneagram is.
Okay, now, again, boy, you know, I'd have to get out another book that explained it better than I'm about to, but...
Hey, Silverdale?
Yeah.
I think part of what we need to do, and I mean, to go, there are volumes and volumes of works on the Enneagram and the Law of Seven.
Yeah.
And we're being introduced to it a little spoonful at a time.
Yeah.
and I don't want to cut you off.
Oh, I'm glad you are.
But what I want to do is for us neophytes is to address the question of, given that there are tensions and movements of these tensions and energies within our organic self, how can we begin to become more aware of the sensing of them? How can we come to a place where we are working with this thing called sensing? Now, apparently, the author is telling us that those forces move in a specific manner, as dictated by the paragraph on the rosary. So that's a hint as to where to see them, and to, as he says in the subsequent paragraphs, to predict them then. But, can we formulate for ourselves on a functional day-to-day basis, in a sense, can we use sensing, or must we go through the other, what step can we take now?
Well, I was actually thinking about just that question earlier today.
Yeah.
In anticipation that that kind of a question might be asked of me. And I would say this. After 18 years, I am still working to know exactly how those movements that are referred to here proceed. Now, I think I'm within a year or two of coming up with a final solution. But in the meantime, the advice I can pass on would be this. And this is Gurdjieff's advice. If you want to learn how to sense, which is where all of this begins, you have to initially self-deceptively believe that you already are sensing. You tell yourself you're sensing whether you believe it or not. And the
believe that you are.
And believe it or not, you actually are. You're just not aware of it. Sensing and feeling are happening simultaneously and incessantly all the time. They are proceeding in you right now, even though you're not aware of it because nobody ever educated you or taught you how to do it.
Okay, so one of the things that we were discussing, for instance, at dinner, was the idea of the quality of attention.
Yeah.
Now, for instance, you may walk into a room and you notice something. You're not sure why you notice it, but you kind of notice something. Something's different.
Yeah.
And on you go. And you kind of file it away somewhere. But if you take the attention and you apply it and you say, what is it I'm noticing? What is it I'm noticing at that moment? That raises it to the level of a consciousness that may not have been there before.
Right.
And in directing your attention to something that is there, pointing to it,
yeah,
and noticing it, that it for the first time, in a sense, gives birth to it. I'll give you an example. I was in New York several years ago. I was working with Evan Lurie there, who's a composer, and he does scores for movies and whatnot. Fascinating fellow, and he was very interested in Argentine music at the time. And he says, you got to listen to this. So he puts this composition on from this very important Argentine composer, and you know, so the composition is going along, and there's a certain phrase in the music, and then he says to me, wow, wasn't that brave? Now, when he said it, I knew it had meaning for him, but him saying it in that manner suddenly popped in my mind about a different manner in which to listen and to pay attention and what might be possible in that particular moment. So in a sense, we have to, like, say to ourselves, I sense something, and in sensing something, it's not I'm in a reactive feeling or I'm in even a higher sense of feeling. I look at it in a way that works for me, and it does in fact work, is think of it as my sixth sense. It's how I perceive the world, quite frankly. And I go about and I look with that eye. I look with that eye and I see in a sense between the cracks in a different manner. And in the chapter, we're told, where is that chapter? Here we go. I lost it for a moment. So it's like, and I like what you said, George Silverdale. I like what you said about putting ourselves, pretend that you can sense. And actually what it is, it's flipping the switch of a consciousness and our attention to the fact that we are sensing, that we do sense. We come together and you sense the other person. And then in working in that with that harmony, there's an interplay that can follow from that. Anyway, I don't know if I'm just carrying on here or what, but if anybody has another thoughts about how they've worked with sensing during the week or... Let me know.
Is Guillermo here?
Yes, Guillermo.
Yes. I was just thinking that perhaps a few things I would like to add. That perhaps that word sensing is what in the common and commonality is called, I got this feeling. I got into a room and I got this feeling. Perhaps the word is not feeling, but that's how the layman and the people in the street call it.
Sure.
I got this feeling, you know, I got inside or I got together with this person, I give me this creepy feeling or I feel so comfortable. Perhaps that's the word more common use for that kind of experience, isn't it?
Yeah, in a sense what we could say is that a particular space has a signature of its own, like call it a mood signature. And,
right.
And part of our opportunity here is to do this thing called sensing on it.
Well, and, you know, Dave, I might add, Gurdjieff himself specifically defines what sensing is and what you should, how you can identify sensing within yourself. He also defines feeling and where in your body you should look for the experience or the sensation called feeling.
Okay.
It's those original definitions by Gurdjieff that are important to understand as you go into anything that EJ has published, because they presume those original definitions and nothing else. And in my case, as I try to put the definition of sensing into words that we would understand collectively, and I feel confident Gurdjieff would approve, sensing is nothing more than the vibratory sensation that arises within our non-phenomenal self. So when we can tune into that, which is already proceeding in us, it's just we've never been educated or trained how to do that, but we can do it by just pretending we already know how to do it.
I was just thinking in those lines too that perhaps it's in the way similar is intuition. How do you train your intuition? Well, you trust it. I don't know if I have it or not, but I'm intuitive that this is going to happen, or the elevator is coming in this way, or this is going to happen. So am I really doing it? I don't know, but I start trusting that, and I call intuition the same way I think sense can be treated in the same way, isn't it?
And I think that what we're being offered here in these 24 exercises in this book are exercising things that are part of our, as I'll call it, our natural gifts, but that we just haven't quite known they're there. And as we begin exercising them, like trying a new exercise or breathing differently or breathing at all, quite frankly, we're learning what we already have, really, but we're practicing using skills and tools. I call it the tool belt, and we're just exercising some of the tools on our tool belt.
So, Ginger Rogers, let me put this in here. She's had a hold that for just a minute, please.
Okay.
Ginger Rogers said, when David speaks of sensing, I wonder if it's the same as an idea I share with my students, the idea of listening not simply with the ears but with the entire being.
And that's a lot closer. Go ahead.
No, I was waiting for you.
Should I go ahead, Tate?
No. Let me finish catching up with the comments. I thought David had something to say. And then Sama said, sensing sometimes through the whole body, or rather out of body, it comes without a logical thought or association. It is very much a sixth sense. And then Ginger Rogers, this form of listening requires the use of something akin to the sixth sense. And Sama said, sometimes it's like reaching outside of the body, the mind, logic, and accessing the vibratory and energetic information around. And then around is trailing off. And Ginger Roger, going back to sit with David, happily I'm in California this week as opposed to my usual space in New York. Okay. David, do you have something to say, or shall we go to Diana?
Just quickly, if I may, T and Diana, to respond to partly to Sama and the general statements that Cynthia has made. I find it quite interesting. So Sama tells us that she perceives something. There's a perception, but no thoughts, in a sense. But yet at the same time, if you are paying attention to that, there's some sense that there's a type of knowledge that comes through. So there's a type of understanding you get, but it's not head understanding. And that's the beginning of a different, let's say, a different modality.
That's very important. That's definitely sensing, and there's an aspect of intuition that's called direct knowing that comes through often on the channel that happens when we practice that.
Nicely put.
Diana?
Yeah, I want to go back to something that Silverdale said and see if Silverdale or T. David, one of you guys can expand on this a little bit. Silverdale, I think you said something about in Gurdjieff's work, he talks about in the body where you sensing occurs and where feeling occurs. Because I was trying to relate that a little bit more. As far as the sensing exercise for me, David, I had something similar to what you experienced where I was, you know, deeply listening to music in Nia class a couple of weeks ago. So I think for me that's a good sense of sense, a good example of sensing, but I couldn't track it through to the depth of this vibratory sensation that we've been talking about. So I would like a further explanation of what, you know, where this is occurring in the body.
Diana, did you say that you were not able to connect it to the vibratory sensation?
No, I really wasn't. You know, I was listening to this music. I was in this Neo workshop a couple of weeks ago, and the teacher had us listen to the music, and I would say I listened and I felt it more deeply. Like, I could get to the point where I could hear or feel a message, but I couldn't tell you what was happening in my body. I was just trying to listen and relax and allow the music in.
Yep. Well, I'm also interested in Silverdale's answer, but a question that comes to mind that you might want to work with at some point is just the idea of, so if you were, in what manner were you listening? You know, how did the listening happen there? And was it just the eardrums, or did something else happen?
That's an excellent question, David.
Oh, it is. It was definitely beyond the eardrums, because it was like allowing a feeling or a message to sort of intuitively start coming through. That's all I can tell you.
So if we work a little bit with the idea that of, like, going beyond what is typically presented to us by the five senses, or I think that's how many we have, and then, like, even in seeing, it's fascinating to practice that one. When you look, and then you look,
okay. And
it allows you to see more. I could probably describe it. It would take a while, though, and it'd take a certain type of effort that maybe I'm not sure if I'm able to make at the moment. But I think I could describe it. But I know that it's more than what the neurons do with what it works with light, how the brain interprets the light that comes in. So we're introduced then to the idea that if we invoke, pretend the whole about this stuff about sensing, maybe it drops a cloth down or it lifts a cloth that's been sitting there that maybe we can work with that we don't need to have in place. That's all. There you go.
So, Silverdale, would you like to step in and answer that question about feeling and sensing?
Yep. You know, again, I'm offering simply the results of 18 years of effort here, and
that's all.
It would take you time to verify whether what I'm saying is true or not. But having said that, we're comprised of three forces, and these forces begin to develop in us and they stop developing in us at definite periods in time. And they begin and stop developing at at different times in a man than they do in a woman. So, for example, the first force in a man proceeds from when he's conceived until the age of 11. And this force allows him to begin to understand the multiplicity and diversity of life. For a girl, this process begins and ends at the age of 9. For a man, the second process, which is the development of the non-phenomenal self, which is the vibratory sensation I'm talking about, which should be as familiar to us as our ordinary consciousness, and it never is because we're not educated and taught how to do this. But what it allows us to do is perceive the unity, undifferentiated unity, in accordance with vibratory sensations. In a man, that starts at the age of 9 and proceeds to the age of 20 when it stops. For a girl, it can start as early as the age of 4 and stops at the age of 13. That's the way nature has it set up. And that ability to perceive undifferentiated unity through vibratory sensation arising from within yourself is called sensing, in accordance with Gurdjieffian terminology.
Okay. So maybe that's a hook that we can grab a little bit. The undifferentiated, say,
unity.
What was it again?
Undifferentiated unity.
And in undifferentiated unity, that kind of rings for me as a way to grok it a little bit or understand it a bit.
Okay.
Is that when you invoke sensing, it's much more universal than the slice of pie that a particular emotion or sense might have. Yeah, you are literally sensing the interconnectivity of the space.
Everything existing. And then, just to finalize this, once you've got those two forces working within yourself, then the third force, which creates what Gurdjieff calls feeling, can begin. And feeling is when you're able to intentionally blend your ability to sense undifferentiated unity in the midst of multiplicity and diversity as you experience life. The blending of those two produces something that's called feeling. And feeling can begin in a man at the age of 20. Of course, it never does ever start because he never ever learns how to sense. But in any event, and in a woman, that ability to feel begins at the age of 13. In a man, feeling will stop developing at the age of 65. All these things can, once you understand these things, you can work around them. But feeling is...
They're workarounds.
There are workarounds for having failed to do it early in life because of parents or schooling or whatever. And that's what Gurdjieff attempts.
And feeling is what?
What's that?
And then feeling is what? Nice summary of feeling.
So feeling is the ability to of your own accord, you know, you just do it, to blend sensing, that is the ability of your non-phenomenal self to experience undifferentiated unity of everything existing. It's like being in white light. Wherever you are, you're able to throw a switch and you are in white light because you know how to do it and you've practiced it. It's a developed muscle. So feeling is the ability to blend sensing together with what we live our whole lives in, ordinary consciousness, which is the ability to differentiate between multiplicity and diversity. You know, we juggle a lot of different things as we go through each day. That's ordinary consciousness. So feeling is the blending of sensing and our thinking, our ability to think.
Great. Thank you very much. Now, Mike Williams said that for me, whole body listening is a good first approximation of sensing.
Very good.
And that's a very nice way to ground it and take it into a good starting place for those of us who are beginning to learn how to sense. Now, I'd like to also read a comment that he made on the website, because I think it's a beautiful example of going into experience and discovering the experience within oneself. And, I just said uh-oh because I'm having some recording problems. So here is his comment. As a child, the HBM, that's the human biological machine, fell and injured the left eye. To this day, some of the muscles involving that eye contract unnecessarily under just the ordinary impact of going through the day. Just the ordinary stress of living leaves a feeling of tiredness, a residue of tension around the eye, while the right eye remains unaffected and untouched by this tiredness and tension. The left eye tires out from this mainly unnoticed contracting, but I have never been able to keep the left eye in its natural relaxed state while going through my day. I'm assuming there is some kind of uncleared shock or anomaly in the electromagnetic field that has some control over the nerves associated with this eye. Just relaxing the eye helps, yet the quality of, quote, attention available to me up to now has been insufficient to clear the underlying anomaly. As long as this remains the case, one center of gravity question I've now formulated is, how can I use this eye tensing as a signal or reminder to stay close to the HBM with the kind of attention that a lover would give to the beloved one? What will allow this one to follow the breath and movement of the HBM as a lover would, to stay close, to be one with the flesh and bones and every little impulse that arises in the sensation body that has also been called the breath body? I like that comment very much as an example of bringing sensing and attention together, and in real everyday life experience, and then using what's going on in order to wake up. And it's just a beautiful example.
If I may, when I listened to what you had to say, Mike, it's this interplay between the lover and the beloved arises when you suspend your judgment in terms of your observing that particular, like if you observe that particular part of the body, of the biological machine that's sitting there, and you observe it with objective non-attachment, gradually what seems to occur for me is a form of compassion. And if you can stick with it, at some point, it seems to, out of that arises a form of adoration. And I believe that it's possible to do literally on that specific an area. You kind of, you wind up holding it in your hands of attention in a certain way. And so it'd be interesting to see how the practice goes on that one.
There's another email comment that I'd like to share, and I think that it may be able to be tied in. And this comment is from Jenny. She said, I had to step back a little from PWOS because I was living in my head so much, and I was offering some resistance and self-judgment on several levels. I'm interested, though, and welcome all the updates. And I don't know how to tell you what content I want. Soon I will be listening again and try from a new place. Now, this stuck place of self-judgment and getting into resistance to the work is something that I think is very common in the beginning. And I suspect that there's a manner of using sensing that will help to break through the thinking and judging. And I'm wondering, based on the comment that you just made, David, whether you could speak to that.
The idea of using sensing to what? Jump over that hurdle of being stuck?
The idea of using sensing and finding what you're calling adoration through the manner of sensing to begin to relax the excessive mental involvement that leads to self-judgment and that the ego will allow to derail the work.
Okay. Well, all of this, in a sense, the entire book that we're working with here is a matter of practice, of getting ourselves practicing something different, practicing being in a different manner and interrelating with the world in a different manner. So for a person who is excessively mental, or, I mean, I don't know who Jenny at all, other than her comments from time to time, but she's saying that she has too many thoughts about it and it derails her in a certain way. Well, the idea is, so what? That's just another factor of observation. And if you take that, and you take that as, excuse the expression, but you take it as holy ground, because that's what you've been given, right? You're given that. That's the deck of cards that came to you.
Given
her
what?
Deck of cards.
Okay, sorry.
Huh?
You're given what?
Her deck is like excessive thought patterns. And so she has that, and she says, oh, I think too much, therefore I can't do this, I'm not going to do it anymore. Well, then what if you just observe it? And just observe the fact that you have monkey mind and that your brain is going to chatter on. Given 1 second of opportunity, it's just going to go and 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 go. And if you watch the darn thing, you go, wow, that's pretty cool. That's pretty interesting that thing that happens to be on top of my shoulders does that all the time. And then you start to watch it and you go, wow. Now, you might even get a hint at some point, and this happened to me. I suffer from that and other things. But you start to get a hint that there was a reason that you did that. It's like there's a reason you adopted that. And sometimes the reason you adopted that monkey mind was because that was a way to protect yourself, and it worked. It worked really well for all your life up to this moment, and you have to kind of say to the human biological machine and the machine at this point, you say, thanks for putting that together. It helped. But now I don't need it quite as much. You know, I don't really need that tool. Now it's going to run on its own. It's going to run on its own momentum and its own habit pattern, and it's like a freight train. Kind of hard to stop, but you can. The power of observation of it is just staggering. It's just so staggering. If you just can place that attention on it, it's like it's like you got a cloth and you're cleaning the silver, and it starts to shine after a while. And just the placing of the attention ever so gently on whatever it is we're observing, I'm going to say cleanses it, but I don't want to say cleanse. It realigns it in a certain manner, electrically or magnetically realigns it, so that it then begins to take on its proper form. You can't take it on head on, but placing that attention on it ever so gently does something quite magical. Did I answer the question?
Yes, that's very nice. I think that's a great starting point, and I think if and as it becomes available as an option, that any exercises in sensing are good antidotes to the monkey mind.
Yeah. Do we want to do a tape change? Is it a good time for you, T?
Yes, I'll just add that Silverdale said self-observation is a basis for self-remembering, and that's very nice wrap-up of what we're talking about at the moment. Let's go ahead and make a change.
I'll make one more comment, though, please.
All right.
Are we still on?
Yes.
Okay. Mike, you there?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The other thought I had about your eye is that it may have a habit pattern, too. There may be a habit of in the muscles that are causing it to do certain things. For some reason, I had that thought, and I didn't want to forget it.
Thanks.
That's all. Okay, tape changes.